Let's call the meeting to order, please. Roll call, please. Sally Channing. Annie Delgado.
Here.
Gary Dunmire.
Here.
Michael Howe. Jean Matthews. Michael Owens.
Here.
Bogdan Pierkowski.
Neil.
Olga Prieto.
Here.
Bob Sabin.
Here.
Heather Trabeau.
Here.
Anna Pushkin Shevlin. Stephanie Thoburn. Alexander Barr.
Okay, great, thank you. Okay, can we, unless there's any changes, can we get a motion to adopt the agenda for today?
So moved, second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Second item, motion to approve the minutes for April 5th, unless there's any changes, deletions, additions. Motion?
So moved, second.
Second by Michael. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None? Thank you. Okay, comments from the chair? Okay, so I do have a couple of comments. The city's West Palm Beach Mobility Plan went to Agenda Workshop on April 30th. If you'd like to see it, it is online at WPB.org. So we'll be moving to go through the adoption process soon, which is very exciting. It's been a long process. We had Gwen Dane come and present to us. And that's our first item. And the second item, we did finally begin the construction process of installing zebras or armadillos to do protected bike lanes. So if anybody wants to go see them, we're testing it out. This was after going out to public meetings and meeting with everyone at Coniston and also working with the TPA to do bike counts in that area. So we do have a biking population for multiple schools, and now hopefully these zebras slash armadillos are working. Yes.
Is there a plan for like a year from now to do another count and see what the increase is?
That's a good idea. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Well, I just think it would be good evidence that the TBA could use for other. Hey, they did it here. This is what it could do for you.
See if they increased bike ridership.
Absolutely. We'll coordinate with the TBA to get counters out there after the full installation is complete, and that the kind of the public is kind of aware of the new bike lanes. That's a great idea. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Welcome.
Hi. Sorry.
No, you're fine. Would you want to? Are you introducing her?
Hi.
Yeah, she is a new member.
I'll
be sure. Okay. So our next item is the BTPAC liaison's report. Item E.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all. It's a pretty short liaison report this month. I just wanted to give a brief update on the supplemental safety measures for the implementation of the quiet zones. The cities of West Palm Beach and Lake Worth have filed their notices of establishment of the quiet zone, and those go into effect 21 days following the submittal of those. So I think West Palm submitted last week, and Lake Worth submitted on Monday of this week. And then Brightline has notified us that in order to speed up completion of Miami Station, so service can start to Miami, they have pulled their contractors down to Miami, so there's a little bit of a delay on the completion for Lantana, Hypoluxo, Boynton Beach, Delray Beach, and Boca Raton, but we have been told that they expect to complete those upgrades by mid to late May. Second item, just a fun one for any of those that may be going to Sunfest. Once again, there'll be a free bike valet service, so be sure to take advantage of that if you're heading downtown for Sunfest. And lastly, as you know, the governing board meetings have been on a roadshow this year, and the May governing board meeting on May 17th will be in the city of Boynton Beach at the Boynton Beach Intercoastal Park Clubhouse, which is a very nice facility. And also lastly, I'd like to welcome Stephanie Thoburn, representative from the town of Jupiter.
Thank you. Welcome, Stephanie. Okay, so our next item is general public comments, or comments on any agenda items. Do we have anybody from the public who wish to speak?
I just want to introduce myself.
Yeah.
I'm Roberta.
actually the new MPO Martin County Bicycle Pedestrian Planner.
Thank you.
I came out of retirement after 2 years.
Joy served on this committee for what, 20 years or?
Probably 25. It was when it first started.
And Boca.
Joy Porter. And her, she was responsible. Boca has such beautiful bike lanes because of Joy.
And is this a new position in Martin County?
No, I think it was an existing position. I live in Stewart now, so it was a good fit.
Excellent, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joy. Okay, so now we're into our action items. Item 2A is a motion to recommend approval for the financial year 19-20 Unified Planning Work Program. Renee will be presenting this.
Good morning. Just to give you a review, the UPWP, you saw it in March. It's our 2-year business plan. It goes from July of 18 to June of 23. It has 8 tasks. We'll go over that in a minute. So we've made some changes since you saw it in March. We've noted the staff services agreement. We've done basically just ministerial items, changes based on comments. So we've consolidated activities, we've done consolidation with carry forward, we've updated the budget tables, we've added this, which is of interest to you all, the countywide bike share program. DOT and FHWA have requested these items. Just ministerial stuff. We've added task 8, which is transfers to other agencies, corrected a math error, added certification assurances, and a FTA grant application. That's basically it. That's my whole slide. That's it. Short and sweet. You have a long agenda today, so I'm trying to be brief. Do you have any questions?
Any questions for Renee?
Thank you.
Can we get a motion to recommend approval of the Unified, the financial year 19-20 Unified Planning Work Program?
I move approval.
Second. Okay. Michael and Michael? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, so we're moving right along for action item 2B, recommend approval for the US 1 multimodal corridor study. And we have
Valerie Nielsen will introduce this item and then bring up some of the consultant team to continue through the technical aspect.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. We are very excited to present this project. We've been working on it for over a year. We kicked it off last May in Boca Raton. This is an MPO TPA now, priority project. And we're looking at all of US 1 from Camino Real all the way to Indian Town Road in Jupiter, 42 miles, looking at how to improve multimodal facilities along the corridor, enhance transit, currently limited stop service services corridor, and Route 1, which is the highest transit ridership route in the county. We're looking at how could we make, where would it make sense to implement express service, how can we make more efficient service, those improvements, and then also how to connect head bike facilities and make them safer wherever we can. Sticking within the right of way of the corridor, here you can see an example. This is in West Palm Beach where there isn't a bike lane and someone's trying to bike on the road. But there's other sections that have buffered bike lanes like in Point Inn and Hypoluxo. So the corridor varies the route. So we're trying to really improve those facilities along all these communities, 14 communities that the corridor crosses. So as I mentioned, we did a lot of outreach, 6 months of public outreach, stakeholder interviews, workshops, charrettes. We had a comment map online where we received a lot of comments. We also did surveys online. We did just a lot of outreach and got a lot of input along this process. So as part of the study, we did 3 assessments. One was our health impact assessment. It's the first time we've ever done a health impact assessment, so we had a health impact assessment or HIA steering committee with our health partners in the community, which we don't always talk to, so the hospitals, Quantum Foundation, United Way, all these other folks that we don't usually talk to, and found some great information and studies that they're doing that are related to us, like access to healthy foods or things like that. And it was a really great collaboration of data and information to help us inform the study. We also did the transit assessment, as I mentioned, looking at express bus service along the corridor, and the roadway assessment, looking at those the vehicles, the bicycles, the pedestrians, how to better move and make it safer for everyone and connect those facilities. So I'm going to pass it over to, we have our two consultant teams that were helped us throughout this entire project. JP with Kittleson helped lead the HIA and the transit assessment, and then Stuart with Kimley Horn helped lead the roadway assessment. So I'll let them talk a little bit more about that.
Thanks, Valerie. And good morning. As Riley mentioned, we conducted these overlapping assessments, each sort of integrated into our overall design and planning process. And sort of beginning this effort was the health impact assessment. A health impact assessment brings together health information about the community as sort of the basis for understanding the potential impacts from planning, policy, and design decisions. We were advised by a working group of healthcare and agency professionals and had multiple public outreach sessions in the form of design workshops, online surveys, interviewing the community. We actually got on the bus and on the Route 1 bus and talked to passengers about their experiences, both getting on and off, how they commute, what they use the bus for, that sort of thing, as well as talking to folks walking and biking along in the corridor. And so based on those outreach sessions and data that we gathered from the health partners that Valerie had mentioned, we generated a picture of health for the US 1 corridor community. Among those issues that raised some red flags was a 43% hypertension rate, a 14% diabetes health-related health issues, and a 30% obesity rate. Those are all higher than the county, the state, and the national averages. So why are these stats higher in the US 1 corridor than in the other areas? We think it's related to the walking and biking conditions on the corridor. We found that there had been about 321 bike ped crashes, with the high majority of those occurring in where areas of no bike facilities or no sidewalks. Additionally, all the fatalities in the corridor occurred in low light situations, as users were either out at night or coming to and from work in the dusk or dawn hours. And we also kind of figured out that the connections between the homes and jobs is a really big deal. 90% of the Route 1 riders walk to the stations that they use, or to the stops. 50% of those are dependent on transit. In other words, they don't have another vehicle or another way of getting to work. They're dependent on using transit to get there. And more than half, or 65% of those Route 1 users do not transfer buses, which means they're staying on Route 1 to go from home to work for this commute. So more than half of the riders are staying within the area. So what does this mean? The indicators, health indicators that we looked at and that we've talked about are directly related to how we plan and move forward with the complete streets and premium transit ideas that you'll see in the rest of the slides. And ultimately, the HIA recommends advancing the premium transit on US 1 and implementing the complete streets solutions. And that then leads to the access and more access, additional access, better access to jobs and education, more access, better access to health and healthy foods and community services and medical services, more economic development as the corridor is easier to traverse and people are able to get around, the overall economic health of the corridor rises, and then of course the bicycle and pedestrian safety, which allows all of these things to kind of work together. So, as I mentioned, the current transit service on the corridor is actually the highest ridership in the county, with about 1.9 riders per year. It goes from the Gardens Mall, Route 1 goes from the Gardens Mall to Boca Raton, and it has about 220 stop pairs along that way. There's also a limited stop service called the Bolt, which runs from the West Palm Beach Intermodal Center to Boca. That has about 12 stops, and its operations are not quite at where they should be for an operation of express service. When we look at the kinds of rides and the kinds of trips happening on the local rail, we see that over 50% of those rides are happening between Riviera Beach and Boynton Beach, and 75% of those are 15 miles or less. So that's a pretty good spot to look at as we start to think about what a premium transit service would be. So after vetting lots of different alternatives and looking at lots of different options, what we've come to is a recommendation to create a new premium transit service called PTX or Palmtran Express. The existing Route 1 would increase its frequency from 20 minutes to 30 minutes, and that shift in funding would allow for the phase one of the PTX Yellow, the premium transit, to be feasible with a certain negligible amount of operating costs, about $280,000. That would add 19 mile sort of BRT loop with 19 station pairs. It would operate in mixed traffic, so it doesn't have its own lane other than one or two spots along the corridor. It will operate on a 10-minute frequency, which means where it overlaps with Route 1, that frequency would see a bus coming about every 20 minutes, and this bus would be coming every 10, and then the local would come in between those time frames. It would operate 4 hours in the morning and the afternoon during those peak hours, and have 1 hour late night runs, so total operation about 9 hours a day. The Bolt only runs 2 hours a day, so that's an increase there. And this area that we've looked at, it serves the highest existing transit ridership percentage, as well as the greatest concentration of transit-dependent riders.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah.
Go back a second. Can you explain what that top bullet means? You said increases from 20 minutes to 30?
Yeah, so that means that for Route 1 in this area, we would look at operating at a 30-minute frequency instead of 20-minute frequency, because you would also have the Palmtran Express overlapping. The cost in less buses and less operation times for Route 1 would help offset the operating cost for the premium transit service.
Okay, and then does that correspond with the 10-minute frequency?
So the Palmtran Express line that's coming through here, there would be a bus every 10 minutes at each one of these stations.
Okay.
And so that's operating that way. All the stations in between that route that the local bus serves, there would be a bus coming there every half hour, every 30 minutes. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
So with that premium transit, we would expect to see about 75,000 additional riders using that service, up from about 10 or 12,000 that currently would use the Bolt service. We also, because of the locations that we're putting stations in, we would see a 17% increase in household and job locations that have access to transit above the current Bolt service. And within a 10-minute walk, we would have 24 schools and 90 healthcare facilities within the 10-minute walk of these stations. Over time, as that comes in, we would want to expand into a phase two and expand south to Boca Raton with 14 additional miles and 11 more station pairs. This portion would operate at 20-minute frequency and operate in the same time frame, and it would capture an additional higher concentration of jobs and residents in the quarter. So when we're thinking about extending it north first or extending it south first, it makes more sense to extend it south first to achieve the higher concentration of jobs and households. And again, finally, expanding it north eventually to Jupiter, we would have additional 9 more miles, 12 more station pairs. The service would extend off the corridor onto alternate A1A to serve the Gardens Mall and the transit stop, and then continue back up and loop back around at Harborside. This would also operate with the 20-minute frequency, so still in the yellow kind of core area, that's still operating at a 10-minute frequency, and then it shifts to 20 minutes north and south.
So I got a question.
Yes, sir.
You're setting this up so that the existing transit routes are done like 130 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you wanted to go and use this service, express service, how would you get if you're on like a slow route in front of your house, then do you walk or how do you expect that to happen?
So what would end up happening or how it would work is with these stations here, if you live somewhere in here, so if you can sort of see all these little black dots, those are existing bus stops. So if you were somewhere here, you could pick up the bus here, take it to there. At Lindell, you would take the express service.
onboarding.
Yeah, where you need to go. So it's adding sort of another layer of faster, more efficient, branded, nicer amenities, transit, where it makes sense. Oops. Anyways, it would add a layer of transit. So the way we've kind of talked about it is, if you think of Tri-Rail, right, that has like, you know, three or four stops, and that's fast, right? Then you have your regular bus service, which has, you know, 224 stops. So even though it's right now today operating at a 20-minute frequency, you're still stopping at multiple stops on your way. So your overall trip length might be an hour and a half to go, you know, X amount of miles. This would be something in between, where you're still using the corridor to travel. You have sort of these stations where it's focused around, again, high concentrations of households and jobs and transit-dependent communities. Would have.
So if I'm not going very far, then I'm likely to go to the local bus and just stay on it to get there.
Right.
And if I'm going a long way, then I'm going to get it on first bus I can get.
Correct.
Yeah.
So
and switch.
Right. So back to the point before, we saw that like it was like 50% of trips were 15 miles or more, or at least 15 miles. So when we think about like that 15 miles, that's where we're looking at the that overall trip. So the first section is a 19-mile corridor area, and we're trying to sort of serve the idea that most of these trips are happening about 15 miles. So what it is somebody that lives, say, in Lake Worth or lives in West Palm is coming down to Bethesda Hospital to work. So they're traveling 15 miles or so, or 10 miles to their job. Riding in on the local route, it might be an hour or 2 hours to get from their house, riding the bus down to here. With this service, it might cut it down to, say, a half hour. Or to, you know, 35 minutes. That's the difference in the two frequencies.
Trade-off. Some people get the trade-off pretty nice, and other ones.
That's true.
As part of the study, that's why we, because currently both services are 20-minute, the Route 1 and then the Bulk, which a lot of people don't know about. It looks exactly the same as the other one. But Route 1, it takes you forever to get places because it's stopping in front of everybody's house.
Yeah.
And the other one, the Bolt, may not be in the best locations to stop. So this reevaluated the Bolt and looked at, you know, where would it really make sense and benefit the greatest amount of people to have these stops and offer a frequent 10-minute service. And so now it's like the normal 30-minute service that stops along everyone everywhere, and then the 10-minute service, which is about a mile apart. So by improving the bicycle pedestrian facilities along the corridor, also helps access it. So you're always within a mile of a stop.
So I was thinking about bicycles, as I always did. And I was thinking about, well, maybe we should be putting bicycle racks at stops.
Yeah.
One of your thoughts. What do we need to think on? And the other one is that you want to make those stops at the higher frequency or the higher.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with the overall 42, now keep in mind, 42-mile express service, so the full length of the county, we would conservatively see about 229,000 additional riders on that express service, 138% increase in households and jobs that have access to transit, and then again within the corridor, 45 schools within a 10-minute walk, 217 healthcare facilities. So when we go back to some of the health impact assessment items that we were trying to look at, you know, part of this is to create a better premium transit service that gets folks walking, gets them to where they need to be, and gets them access to the community amenities that they need. So to your point, in addition to looking at the operations and alignments of a potential service, we also looked at what happens at the station itself. So again, when we look at sort of best practices and research around the country where other similar kinds of systems, BRT systems, have been implemented, one of the key pieces to encourage folks to ride transit and to get what's called sort of choice riders is to brand the stations and add different sorts of design elements to the station that make it easier to run your trip. So some of those would include, of course, a full shelter at each station that is branded with a certain design and look that says, hey, this is something different. There are interactive maps of the corridor. With smartphone integration, we can have real-time tracking so you know when the bus is coming. So as you are leaving your house, if you know it's going to take you 10 minutes to walk to the station, you know the bus is 10 minutes away, you can time it so right when you get there, the bus shows up and you get on. Also, you have off-board ticketing. So before you even get on the bus, you're able to pay for your ticket. And that helps with dwell time and helps keep the efficiency of the overall line running, which then gives a given user a little bit more confidence that if they get there, they'll get on and they'll get to their destination when they need to. There won't be other delays. In addition to sort of those things, one of the other aspects that we heard a lot of folks say was level boarding at the station. And level boarding, one, helps with just on and offs. You don't have to wait for the bus to rise or go up or down or for the ramp to come out for wheelchair access. These things kind of align with the level of the bus. Also, it helps if you have a bicycle and you're going to bring your bicycle, you're going to bring a stroller or whatever you have as you're making the trip. The idea would be the buses that we spec are a Proterra bus, which have some space for bikes inside the bus, and you can just walk your bike right on, to your point. The buses they use today, you can attach the bike up to the front, and again, that may be something that is still a part of the overall process. At the stations, we would also have other bicycle and pedestrian amenities like bike racks and trash cans. And then the biggest thing is lighting. The shelter itself would be lit so that, you know, this area is well lit, but we'd also include pedestrian scale lighting that would light up the other areas. So in the evening and at dusk, these areas would be very well lit. They'd feel much more safe. There wouldn't be sort of these dark areas. And overall, it would sort of read as a total piece. Also, the idea is that we would power this. Each station could be powered sort of in and of itself with solar power so that they sort of have a sustainability aspect to it. Through this process, we actually worked, when we were at the workshops, we had a lot of kids and community members draw up things that they wanted to see. That's where a lot of this information has come from that as well. And also, within the corridors, you'll see when Stuart presents, there are a series of unique situations specifically to US-1. And so we took a look at each of the 42 stations that we are showing and said, how does this module fit into where we're suggesting that station be? And it ends up generating a couple of different module types. And so this is an example of US-1 in Glades in Boca Raton, where the bike lane is behind the on-street parking and behind the station coming through. This is an example on Lindell near Delray Beach, where, again, the bike lane's behind, but there's more of sort of that landscape swale edge there, so you see a connection to the station from there. Finally, as part of this, and again, sort of thinking about how all these things tie together, we also examined when a station comes in and that investment is made, what is sort of the reaction around that area? How can we help guide the way future development may occur? We know that from the market and from other developments that developers kind of, they like transit sites. They know that people are going to come there. They know that this is a destination or it's bringing other people to these areas. So they want to develop in these areas. And we think that it's an opportunity to say, okay, how do we start to create better blocks around these areas? How do we start to create a better infrastructure around this area so that it can handle growth as it happens in the future? So that transit-oriented development is what we imagined. It would have include things like parallel street network to US-1 to help relieve some of the congestion in those areas, help break up the very large blocks into smaller walkable blocks. One of the things we found in the HIA was on the bigger, wider block, folks are less likely to go outside and walk because they don't get anywhere when they're walking down a long block. So breaking it up and having easier ways to get to where you need to go is important. We also think that part of these things needs to include stormwater and green infrastructure facilities so that there are you're balancing the needs for water and all those other kinds of things. Other elements that we talked about were increased density, increased options for affordable housing, and then other, you know, are there other things that we can do to maybe fix some of the transportation issues going on, whether it's congestion at intersections and whatnot. All of this sort of ties together to the complete streets concepts that we were generating at the same time. And with that, I'll hand it over to Stuart to talk about what some of those ideas were.
Thank you.
Morning, everyone. Stuart Robertson with Kimley Horn. The project team conducted a roadway design analysis in order to identify the type of roadway infrastructure improvements to recommend to be implemented for US 1, the purpose of establishing continuous multimodal facilities along the corridor, also integrating the public transit concepts, and also to be reflective of the context that the roadway would be passing through. We based our roadway design analysis on detailed field reviews that were conducted as part of the project, also stakeholder interviews, and I see a number of stakeholders that we interviewed as part of the US 1 multimodal corridor study during our really 6 months of public engagement that occurred last year, which also included public workshops and 3-day charrettes for each of the 6 sections that we segmented the US 1 corridor into. So there was a lot of data gathering, research, and analysis that went into our development of the roadway recommendations. In the report documentation that was linked to in the agenda packet that you all received, we include our proposed recommendations in the form of typical sections within the report, and also within the roadway assessment appendix of the report. And I just wanted to walk you through what those look like so you can become more oriented with what the proposed recommendations are. Each one of the corridors is divided up into a typical section based on the characteristics such as right-of-way width, the number of lanes, whether or not there's a bike lane existing today, how wide the sidewalk is, how wide the separation between the sidewalk and the roadway is. And we actually have found that the road goes through 39 different distinct typical sections in its 42-mile journey from Camino Real to Indiantown Road. So that is a great deal of variation. It speaks to just how dynamic the community is, and also just what a challenge it is to be able to provide continuous multimodal facilities along the corridor. So this is an example of US 1 in Delray Beach between Old Dixie Highway and Gulfstream Boulevard. This is what it looks like today in the existing conditions. And in the proposed conditions, you can see that we have strived to provide separated bicycle lanes along the corridor, consistent with the TPA's adopted complete streets design guidelines, where separated bicycle lanes would be the preferred facility type. Some type of concrete curbing about 6 inches high, which does not have to be continuous and actually should not be continuous. There are breaks in the separation for things like driveways, bus stops, even open channel drainage cuts can be made within the separator in order to make the flow of water be able to get into the existing storm drains. This also is part of the separated bicycle lane principle. When we look at research published in FHWA's Separated Bicycle Lane Design Guide, it points out that the separator does not have to be continuous in order to achieve the desired effect. Having intermittent separation can also provide the effect of motorists using the corridor are aware that there's a separator there periodically, and so they respect that buffer space between the bicycle lane and the motor vehicle travel lane a little more. And also, bicyclists get the sense of protection as they're riding along, but also have places that they can either exit the lane to make a left turn, or that they're able to, you know, don't get the sense that they're completely trapped within that separation area. Also, another one of the principles that we've tried to provide is a better, more robust shade corridor, separating the pedestrian facility from the traveled way. We're trying to provide a furnishing zone that includes shading along the corridor. Each one of the typical sections includes this blue dashed line, which shows you where the existing edge of pavement is. We have strived to provide recommendations that could be implemented within the existing curb and gutter drainage system along the roadway, just for financial efficiency. It's a lot cheaper if you don't have to move the curb. But in some cases, as you can see here on the east side of the road, we were not able to achieve that. So this is an example of what we would call partial reconstruction. Keeping the drainage in place on the west side of the road, but we'd have to move it on the east side of the road. And we did this 39 times over throughout the entire corridor. And actually, for many of the sections, we analyzed various different alternatives. So there were sort of A's, B's, and C's evaluations for each one of these segments before we were arrived at the proposed recommendation. We also note the FDOT context classification, which we hope will assist in the scoping process as these projects move forward into implementation. It wasn't just about the typical sections. We also analyzed the corridor in what's called plan view, so looking at it from the top, and developed these conceptual designs for the corridor. And there's a lot, as engineers and planners, that we can learn from a corridor in plan view that we don't necessarily see in the typical section. So things like being able to provide intermittent traffic calming along the corridor. This is a section that has conventional bike lanes just based on a more narrow right-of-way. We're not able to fit the separated bicycle lane approach. We also see in the plan views the locations of the proposed PTX transit stations that JP presented on. You can see how they would fit within the corridor of the sidewalk passing behind here and the little islands for the bus to be able to pick up passengers. We've also identified locations for proposed crosswalks, mid-block crosswalks that would allow access to the bus stops, striving for median refuge locations within the roadway so pedestrians could cross one lane at a time and then reorient themselves to cross the other direction. That's a safety countermeasure, having those median refuge locations. So just like for the typical sections, we did this for 42 miles of the corridor, which I think is an extensive effort that the TPA has undertaken in order to be able to communicate the intent of the planning study to the engineers that will be picking this up down the road to be able to go into scoping and implementation. Here's an example of a location where a raised separated bike lane passes behind the PTX station, similar to what JP presented on his rendering of the PTX station where the bicycle facility actually passes behind the station. That way it eliminates that conflict between bicyclists and buses that are stopped at a station, because buses have to stop in the bike lane in a conventional arrangement. Here's an example of what the whole thing would look like when put together at the Lake Worth station. You can see the bicycle facilities are added to the corridor here. A PTX bus is in the station on the northbound lanes, also showing the possibility of having a public plaza beside the road, what currently is an empty lot on the northeast corner of US 1 and Lake Avenue. This bus station is one of the locations that we had identified where there's space to provide sort of a pull-off area for the PTX. A Q-jump technology could be implemented at the traffic signal at Lake Avenue, where the bus would share the right turn lane, but the bus would be able to make a through movement. And this also illustrates the possibility of implementing a bicycle box at this location, which is a relatively new technique that has received approval from Federal Highway Administration through the MUTCD interim approval process. We've also conducted a prioritization analysis, and this is really one of the important outcomes of the US 1 Multimodal Corridor study. It identifies separate projects and segments them into more manageable bite-sized projects that can go into a work program type of environment. This is also communicating to FDOT what we think the proposed projects would be coming out of the study. We've identified projects in this column that are already in the Transportation Improvement Program. So looking at the draft TIP, the fiscal year 19 to 23 draft TIP, many of these projects or areas that have projects that are identified in the TIP, we've identified as priority three areas because our improvements tend to be of a nature that's beyond the scope of what could be implemented into a resurfacing project. So since these projects are currently in a resurfacing cycle upcoming, we're able to implement some of the improvements, those that can be implemented within the drainage system on a resurfacing project, but not the broader reconstruction portions or the PTX stations that would have to come later on down the road. So many of our Tier 1 priority projects are those that we have identified that we could be able to achieve a good deal of benefit for a lower amount of complexity and cost. And when you look at the complexity and cost ratings, when we talk about complexity, the way that we've defined that in the table here is kind of more the administrative or the procedural complexity of being able to implement the recommendations. One example of administrative complexity would be if a lane elimination process would have to be undertaken to implement a portion of the recommendations. There are portions of, for example, South Dixie Highway in West Palm Beach that are being recommended to go from a four-lane to a three-lane section, which would have to go through FDOT's lane elimination process. So that would add procedural complexity. The cost ratings, which also is on a red, yellow, green scale, that has to do more with the physical aspects of implementing it. If we're getting into street reconstruction, that's going to be higher costs. It's rated as a red on this scale. If it's full reconstruction. If there's no changes to the drainage, no changes to the median, that's going to be a cheaper project to be able to implement. Probably that could be implemented through a resurfacing scope, that's going to show it green on this scale. So that's how we develop the red, yellow, green ratings for complexity and for cost. And the benefit rating is either green or yellow, depending on, for green, if we're adding new modal facilities that do not exist on a road section, that's going to be green. Or if we are improving modal facilities that already exist, that's going to be yellow. So if we already have a bicycle lane on the corridor and we're recommending converting that to a separated bicycle lane, that gets a yellow rather than a green because there is already a basic form of facility that already exists along the corridor. Our priority tier 1, 2, 3, the key to that is essentially built on the FDOT work program cycle. Our priority 1 projects are things that we think could go into essentially the new fifth year of the Transportation Improvement Program in next year's TIP. So build in 5 to 7 years would be priority 1, 7 to 9 years priority 2, and then build in 10 plus years would be priority 3. Now the TPA has already program design funds in the Transportation Improvement Program for some of the priority 1, tier 1 projects. So there is already funding that is identified for US 1 multimodal corridor study in the TIP, and so the design of those projects would be able to start. So just to orient you with the project documents that are available on the US1PBCorridorStudy.com website, also on the TPA website, we have this list here, which goes through the different types of products that we have. The coffee book, in particular, is sort of a high-level document. It's printed in landscape form. It has a lot of images and graphics, infographics that kind of communicate the results of the study. So this is meant to be for someone who is looking for a high-level overview of the project. Also, we've included the typical sections and the plan views for the Tier 1 projects only in the coffee book. The full report is the more detailed analysis. It is set up in portrait mode, and it includes kind of more of the text of the project that includes the findings and the analysis as to how we have arrived at the transit recommendations, along the backup as to how the ridership was calculated and the demographic statistics that talk about how the, you know, transit system would improve the surface to the local community. It also includes a lot of our graphics related to the station area designs. And then finally, for typical sections and plan views, it includes all of the three different priority tiers, not just the tier one. So that is the report. And so finally, just to conclude, our wrap-up slide here is a summary of what we're asking for from the TPA committees ultimately to recommend going forward to the TPA governing board. And that would be to endorse the conceptual recommendations in the study. Obviously, there will be some, you know, refinement that will happen during the scoping phase down the road. To endorse the priority tier system that we've used to kind of segment the projects into that 1, 2, 3 bucket. To request TPA board to direct staff to work with FDOT and all the different local governments along the corridor to fund the tier one road projects in the TIP. And to ask PalmTran to conduct an analysis to confirm the transit recommendations for PTX and to pursue funding to implement PTX Yellow, which was that middle section of the county that's recommended to occur first between Boynton Beach and Riviera Beach. So that's a summary of essentially the key points that we feel like from the report study that would be the pertinent items for the TPA to consider in terms of endorsing the study. So that wraps up our presentation. I know all of us would be happy to discuss any additional questions or comments that you may have about the report.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just have a quick question, one for JP. Is it, are you looking at having outcome measures for the health impacts of the change in the system?
Yes. So part of the recommendations in the health impact assessment are a series of evaluation metrics that over the next 5 years, over the next 2 years, we've set some baseline statistics based off some of the data that we discovered, and the TPA, as it moves forward, can reevaluate those in 2 years or in 5 years to say, with some of these improvements that have been put in, has this number changed, so we can understand that relationship.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's part of the recommendations that come out of it. I didn't cover it here because the health impact assessment on its own is about 120 pages. So.
Right. And then set question for Valerie probably. Is the TPA considering adopting a health impact assessment in all policy? So you always look at health in any of your projects.
We haven't thought about adopting a policy yet, but this is our first one that we've ever done. So we do want to do these for future multimodal corridor studies. So our next multimodal corridor study that we're going to kick off soon is on Okeechobee corridor. So for that, we'll be doing a health impact assessment as well. So it's a learning process for us as we're as we go through it. So
yeah.
That's something to consider.
Okay.
Can you state your name real quick?
Oh, Richard Hartman, City of Delray Beach.
Okay, thank you. Just make sure we're in the notes. And so I think everybody, there's a lot of questions. So maybe we'll just go down through so everybody gets a chance to ask a question. Is that okay?
Sure.
Do you want to start, Stephanie? No questions for you?
Not yet.
Thank you.
Okay, I have three. I'm very curious about buses on the same level. I think that's a really good idea. And I don't know what a bicycle box is. And then the last one is, I'll ask all three at once. I think sheltered crosswalks where you can stop midway, halfway across the street, especially if you've got somebody on a walker or with a stroller, is great. Can we talk about those three things?
Let's do that. We'll go the buses first. Your question about the raised bus stops.
Yeah.
I'll handle bicycle boxes and we'll all chip in on the third part.
Sure, so I'm not sure if you had a question about that, but yeah, the level boarding.
Can you explain them? Yeah.
Sure, the level boarding, again, basically allows for when the bus arrives at a station, it's the same height of the bus is the same height as the curb, which ends up being, so a typical curb is about 6 inches tall. The raised curb that we need is about 13 or 14 inches high. And so the bus, when it aligns, it actually only has just that short gap between where the bus stops and the curb. There's no vertical change in height.
So the bus remains the same level the whole time. You just have an elevated
elevated station. That's correct.
So you literally can, instead of, and so that saves a lot of time. Instead of having to, like, some buses have those, like, hydraulics that are, like, go up, down, whatever, but most buses don't, and so if there's someone in a wheelchair, you have to take out a ramp, or if you have your bike, you have to go put it in front, but if it's a bus that you can just walk on or roll on, it really saves a lot of time, makes it more efficient.
Well, and there's, so inside, you know how you get in buses, and you walk up a couple steps, and they have those steps.
All at the same level.
I think that's great, especially because VW settlement, Florida's getting $613 million, and part of it can be new transit buses.
That's true. That's correct.
And you can kind of see how the curb is raised up at a higher level, 14 to 15 inches here. This is going to be one of the details that will have to be worked out with FDOT, because in some of our preliminary meetings with FDOT, they've expressed some concern about the much higher curb here. And is that going to require a handrail? You know, is it a sort of slip and fall hazard that you have a 14-inch curb instead of a 6-inch curb, which is standard? So that's going to have to be kind of worked out into how that actually looks when it gets implemented. They don't have a standard for a 14-inch curb. They have a standard for a 6-inch curb.
And it's something new for our region, even though it is a lot of places along around the country and around the world do have BRT, and they have that. And sometimes, well, where I've seen it in person, it's, there is kind of a little ramp with a handrail to get up, like, onto this platform, and then you wait there at the bus shelter, and then the bus shows up. So.
Such a great idea.
I also just want to mention for the big picture is the decrease in what's called dwell time, so the amount of time that the bus stays at the station, right? The decrease in that time, so the increase in the overall route efficiency, means a lower operating cost. So if this, you know, if we had it where the bus has to move up and down, we have to assume a higher operating cost, which then makes, you know, the palatability of spending that money on transit, you're like, oh, well, now it's a much higher cost. So there's enough things that are already driving the cost up. So, you know, if there's little things like this that we can do that help to maximize that route efficiency, it helps on the operating costs.
Well, and this, I write grants for the parks, but, you know, we always can find dollars for capital. It's the ongoing maintenance and operation that are the problem, and I'm
correct.
Assuming that's the same in transit.
That is absolutely the same in transit.
Really.
Bike box.
Comes to the bicycle box. We've identified three locations along the corridor that could serve as good models for the bicycle box recommendation. The primary thing that you should know about bicycle boxes are that they are intended to increase the visibility of bicyclists at the intersection as they're either queuing, waiting for a green light, you know, during a red phase, or you know, as they're passing along interacting with motor vehicles. And so on a green light, everything just happens the way it does now. You just continue to ride your bike to the intersection. The point of the bicycle box and the real advantage of it occurs during the red phase of a traffic signal. What happens without a bicycle box is that bicyclists often are subject to what's called the right hook crash type, where a bicyclist is going to be coming up from behind and a motor vehicle makes a right turn, perhaps a right turn on red or even a right turn on green, really, and clips the bicyclist, not really realizing that the bicyclist is coming up from behind. Right hooks tend to be about 20% of all bicycle crashes, so it's a significant pattern that can be partially mitigated, at least through design. So the purpose of the bicycle box would be that motorists have to wait at their stop bar at a recessed position behind where the bicyclists wait. Bicyclists have their own stop bar that's advanced. And so a field of vision for the motorist is going to be such that they're more likely to be able to see the bicyclist at the intersection. Bicycle boxes are often implemented with a no turn on red condition, although that is not expressly required. But oftentimes, at least in highly urbanized areas, downtown core areas, for example, they're often implemented with a no turn on red condition, which helps to further amplify the safety benefits. There is one ancillary benefit of a bicycle box, is that a bicyclist, if arriving on red, would be able to position themselves in front of a through-moving bicyclist, and then when the left turn arrow comes on, could make a left turn adjacent to a motor vehicle, almost like in a dual left turn type fashion, and enter the bicycle lane on the cross street. And so it allows the bicyclist to position themselves to make a left turn in a way that's different than having to merge across traffic back here, which is the conventional way of making a left turn.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And then the last was the shelter crosswalks. Because I look at, like, for example, I live off of Linton, and I look at Linton and Federal, and if you're not able-bodied and fast, you're not making it across.
Yeah, so we've tried to identify locations for crosswalks that would be able to have pedestrian refuges or medians in the middle.
We'll show a slight example of that up in the top there.
Yeah, I see that. I like that up there.
Yeah, and so that can work both as signalized as well as unsignalized crossings, having that median in the middle. It also is a form of a little bit of traffic calming. Having this median sticking out a little further means that motorists can't take the turn quite as fast. They're going to have to mind the median nose there.
Thank you.
A couple other things on the bike box. One of them is if you've got a semi truck, you get out in front of the semi truck, and you'll really get hooked, right hooked with the semi, because he can't even see you over back over there, and you're just cut off. The other one is, and I didn't realize hear of anything about this before, but before you mentioned it, but the left turn ahead of the traffic. There's a spot in Jupiter with the new bridge that's now going to be reconstructed, and that this signal would help, because you get a situation where you're either going to put all the bicycles on the left-hand lane, and then you have to get them over, cutting across all the lines, and with this you would let them wait, and then when the signal turns, you go out in front, and you don't have to get all these bicycles trying to pull over that left-hand turn. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Which intersection?
This is coming off of the bridge.
Coming downtown?
This is on, it is on one. Mm-hmm. That's that spot where you come in, a right-hand turn, and then go across the bridge is going to be reconstructed.
Yeah.
Okay. But coming back the other direction.
So coming off of A1A, onto US-1.
You would come from you would come off of A1A, come south onto US-1, go over the bridge, and particularly now with the new system, you're going to have left-hand turns there. And the issue is, how do you start further back and get all the bicycles over to across the left-hand lane when the traffic's going? And it becomes a real hazard. If you just said, all bicycles wait until the next light and put them in the bike box, and then go out before, and you're not cutting across all these other lanes, it's really a lot safer if you can get them communicated with.
I'll bring that up to Alex Barr, the Complete Streets Coordinator at FDOT District 4. I think that would be in FDOT's jurisdiction.
Yeah.
It is a little bit outside of our study area. We went up to Indiantown Road, is the northern limits of our study area.
Yeah, okay, right.
So I'll speak to Alex about that location.
But it was mentioned, I just vaguely remember this thing. Anyway, it's a real issue up there. I know we were trying to figure it out. I couldn't figure it out.
Thank you.
And another thought. Bike lanes. My concern is with some of the bike lanes where you're going to go behind
the bus shelter.
Bus shelter is that transition from the bike lane to get around. You get in a situation where if you're going along at 20 miles an hour, and all of a sudden you're cutting around a lot of pedestrians, mm-hmm. that's an issue. I'm sure you've thought about that. But that was, I was looking at some of those things and I said, how are you going to get those bikes out behind there?
Right. Yeah, it is an issue, and we've identified those locations where we do have the separated bicycle lanes. So you already have some sense of separation from motor vehicle traffic. We've designed the transition at an 18 mile per hour design speed. So that's still a pretty gradual transition, pretty long transition for bicycles to go behind. One thing to know, though, as a cyclist, there would be a crosswalk where pedestrians would access the bus shelter from the sidewalk. So there would be a crosswalk across this bike lane that's behind the shelter to provide that way for pedestrians in an ADA compliant path to get across the bus shelter.
And to build on that, at least the way we've shown in the plans, is that's actually a raised crosswalk on the bike lane. So if you're coming along, you're going to see some little chevrons saying there's a ramp ahead and that you need to slow down. It might even be marked with a, you know, there's a crossing here. So kind of like the way a trail is designed when it's coming up onto, you know, either a sidewalk or a street, the cyclists would know, you know, looking down that there's something coming up, and then, you know, slow down. You know, and we say lots of people, you know, we always sort of plan for like the worst case scenario, but the reality of people coming on and off the bus, there's lots of other things happening. So it's not a situation where, you know, we've got like downtown Tokyo and people, you know, massive, you know, people are coming across. So that interaction, we want to provide enough, you know, striping and signage so that everybody's aware, but also that change in vertical, the little ramp up, you're going to feel that just as you would if you're a vehicle going over that. And so it's the same kind of method. We don't want to stop the flow, but we want to say maybe you need to, you know, slow down through this thing, speed back up afterwards.
Okay.
Do you have a question?
No.
Michael?
No, I don't.
Neil? Michael?
Right. David. I had two questions, actually. You had mentioned bicycle capacity on the buses themselves. How many buses or how many bicycles would the buses be able to hold?
That's a great question. What I should stipulate in this is, we looked at a specific bus type called the Proterra, is what we spec'd out as an electric bus that would run on this. It's an American-made bus. Those have different features that can be added at different cost price points. So ultimately, PalmTran would need to make a decision about that specific bus and what goes on it. But there is the capacity on those to have like the boarding door, but there's also a secondary door that opens up and you can bring your bikes on. And typically those can fit like 3 to 4 bikes, you know, where there's no seats. And so you would sit there and you can either lock your bike or there's like a mechanism to attach your bike, you know, so you can go sit down while you ride. And usually it's about 3 or 4 bikes for that. Today I know they have the infrastructure on the front of the bus to put the bus on the front, bike on the front of the bus in that case, but I think bringing it onto the bus is
helps with time.
It helps with time, and it's a direction they're willing to go.
It would be expanded capacity too, because they can only hold 2 bikes at this point.
Right.
Okay, well, my second question was regarding the shelters. They have a lot of features in them, and I think a lot of those features would genuinely be useful. But do you have an approximate cost of what they would be?
Yeah, so I think each shelter, each station area, so including the other bike and ped amenities, everything that we showed in that one module, it's about $200,000 each for one of those.
It's kind of
so for one stop pair, that's $400,000 because you have one on the northbound and southbound. And that's what we factored into our overall capital costs.
And how many of those were there total? On the whole one corridor?
Okay. For the whole corridor? 42 stop pairs.
Phase one,
there's 19, and that adds up to about $21.2 million for capital costs on the stations.
Okay. That's it.
We'll go through here first, and then
just globally, maybe just for Valerie, I know you said that going over towards westwardly to Okeechobee Boulevard, will ever get to the western world, like there? Southern Boulevard with the connection from Belgrade all the way to connect to the West Palm Beach stations and stuff like that. I don't know if it was in the discussion, just minimally at least. There had to have been a connection of some sort.
Yeah, we're, you know, this was such a huge project. It's our first, you know, multimodal quarter study, but we plan on doing more. Our next one is the Okeechobee quarter study coming from US 1 T-boning with this in downtown West Palm Beach, where the TED site is, and going west and figuring out what the best connection is over to the Wellington Mall. So, but yeah, But we plan on doing more multimodal corridor studies and then also looking at it in our long range transportation plan. And State Road 80 was looked at for transit in as part of a State Road 80 corridor study that DOT was leading recently as well, looking at what options for the future for that for moving people east west.
That's great. This is fabulous. Congratulations.
Yeah, no questions. Just looking forward to seeing the final product. I can't wait to read through. Especially, I'm so intrigued about Glades and US 1. That's going to be really great. Thank you, guys.
And hopefully, well, we have the typical sections that are Appendix C, the before and after. They're also kind of within the report where you can see the before and after. But then the plan views really through. Leaves no room for doubt because it really shows you how it's gonna, how we envisioned it going through the entire thing.
I'll have comments too, but I'll let Rashid, and I guess he has a question. Can you just, in case not everybody knows who you are, we just.
Rashid Mohiuddin, Planning Division, Palm Beach County. My question is that mid-block crossings or bus stops, did you run into any situation where there is a long block, maybe quarter of a mile or half a mile, and how do we get people, that has always been a problem. They, you know, when you have a bus coming from the other side that you need to, can you just run through the...
Yeah, we have, we identified street. Several situations like that, especially in the higher speed areas of US 1, such as between Glades Road and Linton Boulevard. Especially the further north you get up into that section, the distance between traffic signals really kind of spaces out. So we've identified in that area some mid-block crosswalks that would be new, that don't currently exist today. They would have to go through FDOT's process because it is a higher speed area. They likely would require some form of signalization, a pedestrian hybrid beacon with a push button perhaps. Which is another MUTC compliant and FDOT compliant beacon. You don't see a lot of them. It's relatively unconventional for the state highway system, but it is something that meets FDOT standards, would require an individual study. Also in the area, basically around North Palm Beach and Jupiter, identified some new crosswalks in that area as well. So we did take a look at that specifically, the idea of some additional crosswalks.
Okay, thank you. I would just like to say thank you. You guys, you did a great job, the TPA leading this, and your process was fantastic. Your team was beautiful, Phil's not here, so let him know. And the TOD stuff is amazing, it's taking it above and beyond. Thank you. And your outreach process was beautiful, going from city to city and really doing true outreach. It was really nice, and the outcome is great. And I'm looking forward to a little bit of dedicated bus lanes and the separated bike lanes. So thank you, guys. Did a great job.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, can we get a motion or to recommend approval for the US 1 corridor study?
I recommend approval for the US 1 corridor study, and I applaud you for including help in the matrix.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And a second.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, great, thank you guys,
great job.
Okay, now we're on to item number three, information items, the draft financial year 19-23 transportation improvement program. Okay, great.
Andrew Euler, our TIP coordinator, will be walking through this item.
Everyone. So this is just for informational purposes for this month, and you all see it again next month for your final review, and that'll be going to the board for adoption. So this is our transfer station room program for fiscal year 2019 through 2023. And if you don't know already, this is basically a work program. So all the federal and state funds go into our county for the next 5 years. We also include in here all the local projects we can from the local municipalities. So I usually go in and look at the capital improvement program, or I'll reach out to some of their staff to try to put those in there for informational purposes. Here's a timeline of sort of how we've got to this spot. Now, you know, you're reviewing it this month and then also next month, but it's really a long process to get to this point. So the TPA project priority list was approved in July of 2017. And then after that, after that evaluates the available funds and costs, so how much they're going to have for projected revenue over the next 5 years, and then they allocate all the funding and products there. And then they release their draft tentative work program, and that's reviewed by the committees and then approved by the board, and that was November 2017. And then here we are today, so they released their draft work program for this upcoming cycle, and then we base the TIP off of the draft work program. So those two documents are consistent, and that's what we're doing today, we're reviewing those. And then the final adoption again next month, and then we'll be operating under the 19-23 TIP. It's based off of the state fiscal year, so July 1st, 2018 to June 30th, 2019. So it's coming up pretty soon. Gonna go through a few slides about updates to the document itself and some new material, and then I'll get into some of the product-specific questions or product-specific things we wanted to show you and highlight. It doesn't look like we have anybody from FDOT here today, and it also looks like our director's out of the room, so anything very product-specific, I might have to get back to you.
No pressure, Andrew.
And it's a huge document, so I'm not gonna cover everything. So if you have any questions, you can always contact Kevin, or I, or Alexa. So we'll get those answers to you before our next meeting. Okay, so updated content. You all saw we had a lengthy discussion in every committee meeting and also on the board about performance measures. And this last one that we adopted was the targets for safety. And we still to come are some other ones, system performance, bridges and pavement. And those are due in November. Those will also be integrated into the document as well. So we're trying to move towards how our projects, you know, helping the system based on these measures. And then to be completed by the final version, so next month when we come here to show you the document, we'll have some revised transit projects costs. We're still waiting from Palantran on those. And then maps by fiscal year construction, so that's something that we added last year around, and it seems to be pretty popular. So they'll be staying and updating those maps. And then any revisions that you all have to give us, we'll be trying to incorporate for the next version. So a little bit about the projects and how we sort of categorize them in the TIP. We have our main TPA priority projects, so that's our project priority list that's approved by you all on the board. And in that is the major TPA projects, those and then also all those competitive application processes we have. So local initiatives, transportation alternatives, and then SunTrail at the state level. And then also included in the TIP, all those major FDOT projects and their system capacity, the strategic intermodal system. And then other products that we put in there as well, other FDOT products that aren't part of the system capacity, and those local projects that I mentioned. There's also plenty of airport, rail, and seaport projects. And then major maintenance, and then operation maintenance of roadways and transit. So if you looked at the document, so there's the major document, all the products, but the first 20 pages or so is gonna be the executive summary. And in there, there's the breakdown of those major categories I just mentioned for TPA priority projects, LI, TA, and SunTrail. And those are all tables. So when you're looking at a table, you'll see over here for LI and TA, the year and priority of those. So that's sort of how that works is, you'll see the year the product came on board and then its priority in the system. And this table gets updated so when product goes to construction, they usually get taken off this list. So you'll see a lot of major TPA projects and LIF projects coming off the list. And then you can also see the total cost by fiscal year over here. And next would be the needs, the funding still needed to implement the project. And then the status update for some of the projects if we felt it was necessary to include. So for example, a lot of these might be, you'll see here this is still showing up for these Palm Grand signal prioritization. We still show them on the list because they haven't been implemented yet, even though they've already programmed those funds before fiscal year 19. And the same for these other ones, you know, this FDOT Southern Boulevard at Simsbury Way intersection. So that's going to construction in 2018. So we wanted to keep it on this list until it goes to construction. So just a few highlights from the major sections. Major TPA projects. So these are the ones that require ties from our cost feasible plan, the long range transportation plan 2040. And our target's generally around 200 million in 5 years. We've had some what you see here for fiscal 19 to 23 is only 101 million. Well, it's not usually a consistent trend of how much we're getting programmed into these years. So it's sort of ebb and flow, so higher, sometimes higher amounts, sometimes lower amounts. And that's why you see such a low figure right now. And what I mean by that also is we've had a lot of projects, not only fiscal 18, but in 17 as well, that were programmed for construction. So there's major widening projects, definitely have large tickets on those for budget. And then we have a lot of funding still needed. So in that needs column I mentioned for the, in the summary tables, you'll see plenty of costs there. So for example, Okeechobee Boulevard corridor study has a needs column there. There's an updated cost estimate for all phases of the US 1 corridor study. And then there's, I think, a few other. Atlantic Ave has a big construction possible to be implemented. And then Tri-Rail extension in Jupiter is another one in there. So those are all, you know, large costs that are still needing to be put into the TFP. And some other highlights, Batwell Road from the current TIP going into the new TIP fiscal 1923, moving construction up to 20. Atlantic Avenue, construction moved back to 22. And then there's the State Road 80 lighting study, which was one of our priorities for two of our board members who really wanted to see lighting on that section headed out to Lake Okeechobee. And there's a study in there for fiscal year 20. That's red because the board is really looking for implementation, not just a study. Turnpike summary, there's a few updates. The widening 6 lane for Boynton Beach Boulevard, toll plaza to Lake Worth, is in fiscal year 19 now. And then you can see the widening 8 lanes for Glades to Atlantic, push outside of fiscal year 23. And then there's design funding for a lot of other sections for 8 lanes and also for 6 lanes. So just design funding, not any construction, so that'll still be later on in a couple of years from now, outside of 23. And then go through local initiatives. So this is that annual competitive application process. And we typically get around $20 million of federal funds. This is from the Surface Transportation Block Grant Program. And we get about $20 million every year now. It's been going up every year, so now it's around 20. That's about $100 million totals we're sort of looking for in the TIP. And you can see the 18 to 22 and the 19 to 23 amount, $84 million. So that looks a little lower than $100 million. So the reason for that is we actually have a little bit of those funds are a little bit, $8 million or so are being used for our priority projects. So before we started this program, we were putting money towards that. So a few of those have surface transportation funds on those that would usually be dedicated towards this. But if you look through the projects, you start seeing that a lot of this surface transportation funds are starting to be used, the full $20 million for this program. We added 7 new projects this last cycle, and those are set for construction in 22 and 23. And then we're working with some applicants to resolve some outstanding issues. So there's some projects out there that still need some coordination with FDOT, and there's some resolutions that haven't been gotten in yet. So those are projects that are on the fence of whether or not they're going to stay in the program because of the timing. So we're trying to work all those out. And then if we can't work those out, of course, you all will know about that. And then we have reserve funding of $23 million. So, and those are in the outer years as well. So that's around fiscal year 22 and 23. So these new projects that come in for construction are pretty far out. So the next ones, like this one was 23 for this last round. But we had a little bit of money left in 22 in reserve. So a few of those ones that are top priority can sometimes accelerate by a year, which is nice. Transportation alternatives, so this one's one that you all are pretty familiar with. We get a little over $3 million a year, and you can see that we're spending all that right now for 19 to 21. And there's four new projects for construction in fiscal year 21, and then this is that last cycle. And then again, we're working with applicants to resolve some outstanding issues. I probably don't need a point. I didn't realize I was with that. So. Sun Trail program. Yes, so this is a state funding source, and it goes through them. It's about $25 million a year, and you can see the map there of what areas are eligible for those funding. We have one project right now that's in this system, and that's US 1 Broadway Avenue project, which I believe originally was a lane narrowing and then putting in bicycle lanes.
Multi-use
path down the middle of the median. So, but they're working with FDOT, and I think they need to create a new sample section. So they're still working through all that. It might be delaying the project a little bit. So you'll hear more about that.
Yeah, so basically, this project has been delayed. We didn't make the timeline to agree upon a typical that DOT was happy with. So the TPA is working with the City of West Palm Beach, and maybe we'll use the one that we have this multi-use path on the west side in the US 1 study. Maybe that's, we can work with that concept and possibly make the next year's deadline to submit and maybe then get prioritized for funding in the future. Right now, because we missed that deadline, there is no guarantee for that funding in the future. However, this was the only SunTrail application from our county, so that would make us more competitive for future years because they try to spread it around.
Ask a question, please.
Yes.
Are there other roads that you might recommend? Because I understand they have to be on the priority map in order to apply for SunTrail funding, and then there's a lower priority map, I think, opportunity. Roads.
That's probably what that, the different colors are there. I don't have a list on that.
But I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on, for connectivity purposes, you know, what we should submit to. We have to apply to even get on the map first before we can apply for central funding, so.
I don't know if we've analyzed where.
We did, a couple years ago now, we completed a Greenways and Trails plan or map for the county with
okay.
existing multi-use trails and different types of trails, and then propose where there would be good connections to those.
Yeah.
So that's available on our website, and that might be a good resource to
okay.
identify those
yeah.
connections.
It's pretty easy to apply to just, you know, be listed.
Yeah.
All look and
sure.
take advantage.
And also, no, we did, the City of West Palm Beach did a resolution a while ago dedicating where the Sun Trail would be, I think, consistent with that.
Oh, okay.
That helps too.
It's part of the East Coast Greenway, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen the East Coast Greenway map, and we're trying to connect to that. But it's, you know, there are challenges on making our connections meet their standards
mm-hmm.
or the Sun Trail standards.
Sure.
But that's great. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
So, but as Ali mentioned, that's a good point. There's only been one submittal from our county, so $25 million a year for the state. So if you guys have some projects out there, I think last time the deadline was around December. So
yeah, December 15th.
Okay, so if it's the same this year, it gives you some time to get that together. Construction highlights. There's only a few mentioned here, but if you look in the document, there's a summary table that has major construction highlights for fiscal year 19. And these are our construction highlights that aren't already mentioned in the other tables. So ones that you might not see there. Ford Turnpike 1, we've already mentioned this one, a large one, Boynton Beach Boulevard to Lake Worth Road. That's a whole lot of Boulevard. I-95 from Glades to Linton, managed lanes, and then I-95 Glades Road interchange approved. And there's a few other ones going on as well. And then that list goes on for a few pages. There's a lot of large resurfacing projects that are in there from the county and other projects. So it's a good one to look at. Significant changes. This will probably be expanded the next time you see it next month. So I'm doing more of a comparison now about cost changes between our current TIP and the new TIP. So it's not always easy to figure out which projects really went up cost. So next time you see this list, it'll probably be expanded. But there is that new project, I-95 Palm Beach Lakes Boulevard, which is gonna go for design in fiscal year 23. And then there's these new resurfacing projects. So a large portion of the US 27 west from Henry County line to State Road 80, construction 21, and then Lake Worth Road, you see there, and Forestville Boulevard. All those set for construction in fiscal year 21. This is my last slide. So this is a new one. We're still trying to figure out the best way to show you all this. So we want to make sure we're trying to track our long-range transportation plan projects and ensuring that what we have in our plan is really being implemented. And in our plan, it's separated into the CIS Turnpike projects, so those major DOT projects, the TPA major projects, and then we also include county, city, and private projects that are in there. And then we have mentioned here, just for reference, the local initiatives, transportation alternatives, and air, rail, and sea. Those aren't specifically mentioned in the document, the LRTP, because those first two are those lump sum categories that we have for a competitive application process. But we wanted to show you sort of those statuses as well about which ones are going on. So that first column here is the amount of products in the plan, and then their status as of this upcoming 19 to 23 TIP. So we have right here underway or complete, and then we have in TIP, and includes a construction phase in the TIP, or it's in the TIP with no construction phase. And then lastly, not programmed. So if you see the amount of products over here, for example, the CIS has 31 in the LRTP, and a lot of them are already going on. They only have three that have not been programmed yet. So then you see, compared to the TPA major projects, 45, and really a lot of them have not been programmed yet. A reason for that is a lot of the TPA major projects that we have in the plan are actually sort of in the later years, outer years of the long-range transmission plan. So a lot of those are set to really start to be implemented in more of the 2030 timeframe. And I believe that is my final slide. Yes. So.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Any questions for Andrew?
Question
for you, the TPA major projects, who
administers
those?
They tend to be administered by FDOT. Yeah, I'm not sure there's any time that we don't have. Boutwell Road would be administered by Lake Worth, but for the majority, they're administered by FDOT. And I believe in the list, your table?
We have in the list, that on in the second column says lead agency, and then that shows who will administer it. So some are DOT, but for example, the FEC Railroad Crossings is Brightline, Elder Florida, Palm Tran, SFRTA. So in some cases, the city, if it's a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, but typically,
so
most of the road
table.
Products will be.
But that would go in city, county, private, or no?
Oh, no, those would be, it would still show up in our major projects list.
Okay.
Is that correct, Kevin? Is Boutwell Road an LRTP major project list?
It is, yes.
Okay.
Boutwell is.
Turnpike widening is pretty long overdue in the South County. Did they give any reason why they are shifting it?
We'll have to speak with them about it. They're in the room the other day, but nobody really asked that question. But we can follow up with them about the turnpikes.
Any other questions? If not, can we get a motion?
I
If you go through it again, like I said, we're available to
ask good questions. Okay, great. I'm ready. Thanks. Thank you, Andrew.
Yep.
And now we have the countywide mobility fee. It's our next item.
I'm going to leave you a little bit.
Oh, okay. Okay, so this is Kevin now?
Yes.
See you all from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, so many of you been on the committee and will remember having discussions on this topic last year. So the first thing I wanted to kick off with is, why are we here again? So we had, I think it was in our March committee meetings and board meeting, a recommended alternative moving forward with respect to the current road impact fee that is collected. At the time of the five-year strategic plan update, which occurred in July, there was a deadline set and approved by the governing board of June of 2018 for board approval of a preferred alternative. Because last year, when it was discussed at the board, there were still some questions and wanted us to follow up, have a workshop, which was held last summer, and more communication at staff level. So, referencing that workshop last year, kind of concluded with three options. There wasn't any direct path forward that came out of that workshop. It was to either recommend an alternative for TPA endorsement, recognizing that the authority of this is not the TPA governing board. What they would be doing is providing a recommendation, so they would adopt a resolution requesting that the county commission look at X, Y, or Z. Second was just to recommend retention of the existing system, or to define additional information needed for another workshop. We are going with bullet one today. So I'm not going to go over the status quo. I think most of you are familiar with it, but briefly, the road impact fee as it is structured today is only for road capacity projects. With that said, it can still include the addition of bike lanes. So for instance, if there's a widening that's going to take the road from 4 to 6 lanes, the road impact fee funds can also fund the addition of bike lanes as part of a road capacity project. But the funds could not go towards a standalone bicycle project, pedestrian project, or transit project. What our proposed alternative at this point is to transition that to a still a countywide system, but a countywide mobility fee. It would still be paid at the building permit stage. Would be administered by Palm Beach County, but with some changes. So one, there would be smaller zones. So that way, right now there's 5. So funds collected within a zone have to be spent in that zone. But because they're so large, what we've seen is a lot of the funds that may be collected in the Eastern Core are going to road projects further west within those zones. There would be an itemized list of multimodal projects and associated costs. Per Florida statute, a mobility fee has to have dual rational nexus, so it has to be based upon specific projects and costs. What we're proposing is, as part of the 2045 long-range transportation plan process, is where we would identify all the transit needs, pedestrian needs, bicycle needs, and road capacity needs, that's still a part of it, to define what those fee structures would be. And typically, in other examples of places that have adopted mobility fees, what you'll see is in the more urbanized areas where roadways are pretty much built to right-of-way, there's not really any road capacity projects. It's going to be more additional sidewalk needs as you're urbanizing the area, additional pathways. The fees tend to be lower in those zones as opposed to the areas where you're seeing a lot of future land use amendments to bring in new suburban-style residential, because there's often significant road capacity projects needed to support that. There would also be a unique fee for each zone. Today, each zone, there's the same assessment levied, whether it's a single family residential has a certain fee, multimodal, varies by that. But within each zone, it's the same for every new single family unit. This would be different. There would be different fees within different zones. And then lastly, municipal input in project selection. So what we'd like to see is a selection committee that would meet annually, made up of county as well as municipal staff, to select the projects that would then go into the five-year program. And lastly, that municipalities would have the ability to opt out of the county system on the condition that they have adopted a local mobility plan and mobility fees. So you could just opt out and not charge anything. In terms of the implementation steps, just laying out the timeline that we've proposed, it would be the TPA would endorse the proposed alternative in June or July. I think at this point we're targeting June, but could be July. The county commission would need to authorize a vote on a charter amendment. This is a significant piece because, as was discussed by the county attorney at that workshop and through subsequent conversations, the charter at language as written today limits the use of the road impact fee to how it's structured today. So that would have to go to a countywide vote. So you have September of 2018 to make the November general election. TPA board adopts the updated 2045 long range transportation plan. Our due date is October of 2019. We're targeting September of 2019. And again, that would be the development of the multimodal project list and costs. We would look at anticipated developments within each zone, the proposed smaller zone boundaries, and the proposed mobility fee for each zone. Then the next step would be the county commission amending the Unified Land Development Code Article 13 to implement the mobility fee. And then going back to the project selection committee I referenced, that would meet annually, made up of county and municipal staff. We would review development activity over that prior year and select the mobility projects. And that is ratified by the county commission. The mobility fees would be updated biannually. There's currently a biannual process in place that reevaluates all of the impact fee amounts for road, for parks. So there'd still be a biannual process. And again, the opt-out. So then what we'll be asking the governing board is endorse the recommended alternative and a signal to the county commission, or direct us to not discuss this further, pursue this further. So, and that is my last slide, and we'll probably use some discussion.
Thank you. Some questions?
You know, I often hear about the last mile, like the last piece of land. Like if GL builds 300 units, sometimes they have to make a left turn lane and add a signal, right? And then what is the policy right now with like the last guy coming in kind of gets more road improvements put on them?
So there's a proportionate fair share process. So that it looks at, so it wouldn't put the whole project cost on one developer. It's an evaluation of, well, this development adding this much development potential creates this much of the need for the project, and then they may only have to pay 10% of what the whole project cost would be. So the proportionate fair share structure is kind of how that works.
Oh, okay, so it's kind of equal among them all.
Right.
No, because I do the impact fee report for the parks. Would this allow, say you're in an urbanized area and you're doing infill projects and there's no road capacity, would it allow for complete street improvements with those impact fees?
Yes, and that's the intent. So this would allow for, could be a standalone trail project, it could be a complete streets project, it could be a transit capital project. It would open up the types of projects that could be funded with the money collected.
It's not just about vehicular capacity anymore.
Correct. Right.
That's a big change, and that's a very positive change.
Any other questions?
I have one. Have you started to look, I'm sure you have, but on the comparison of the difference in the fee schedule between what is today and what is now, and then, I mean, as part of this process, mm-hmm. have you looked at outreach for the development community?
So the, a lot of those details and what those fees could look like would come through the, as we get further into the long-range transportation plan update, because that's where we're going to start defining, because we're creating a modal forecast demand. So for this long-range transportation plan, instead of as relying heavily on the CERPA model for the road capacity needs, we're going to develop a tool that looks that can assess the pedestrian demand, the transit demand, the bicycle demand, and that will then feed those that project list and will have associated costs with each. So that's still a forthcoming step. It's a critical step, but we don't have those specifics at this point.
And you asked about outreach and development in the community?
Yeah.
That, I'll think more about that. This is coming back next month as an action item.
Okay.
So I will, that's a good question, and I'll come back to a point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of selling it.
Sure.
Or not, if you have smaller zones where, you know, in more urbanized areas, you may have a greater fee, but in a suburban area or more rural area, that fee may be less. I don't know if those are just generalities that could be produced and shared.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or even if you want to do infill of affordable housing, maybe it has a little bit of a reduced fee.
You need to ask an attorney about that.
Is it going to the PPA board on 17th meeting as an informational item?
Just as information, correct. And then it will be coming back either in June or July.
Doesn't look like you have enough details in there for the information, but that's fine.
Well, this, so what we want to highlight is there is a lot of work that has to happen to do a mobility fee. What we need at this point is that initial sense from the county commission is if that's even a path they're willing to go down. So that signal will then be like, okay, now we can really get started on the work to support it, as opposed to doing all that work, developing it, and then it's not going anywhere. So we do recognize that there's a lot of work over the next year and a half that has to occur.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, so next we have item 3C, our upcoming project list.
So there's no presentation. This is just, like I referenced, I think it was in the February meeting, but this is something we're going to regularly do as it's updated on a quarterly basis. So that way you all can look through it on your time, and if there's any specific projects that jump out to you or you have questions on, you can reach out to me or Alex Barr on those.
Okay, could we, I know one of the ones is like 6th Avenue South in front of John Prince. There's several that are in front of parks. Could we pull those out if I sent an email early enough? Could we review a couple each month, the road plan, so we know?
Yeah, or you can depending on how much time it would take it to me, what you can do is email me those. I can do a little bit of follow-up to get more details on what that looks like or if there's any conceptual plans or anything, and then I can share those with you.
That'd be great.
And I had a question regarding it.
Yes.
The meeting set on the chart, does that mean that they are set, or does that mean that the green and red?
Okay. Yeah. So for instance, looking at under constructability, the first green.
Or scope review. Yeah. What are those? Yeah.
So that would be that level of plan. So there's the initial plans, then there's the constructability plans, and then there's plans at bidability. So the green are showing plans that will be released at the constructability level, green within 3 months, and then the darker ones are within 12 months. And then the red is a previous date.
Okay, so it's kind of seeing what's coming?
Yeah, so green are the soon to be. They're within 3 months.
At the beginning it says that they're going to work with each of the municipalities, so does that mean the date is when a meeting is set for scoping on the original scoping?
The scope review, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Great.
Yeah, there is under there.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Okay, great. So the summary points from the governing board meeting.
Okay. Those are in your packet for review at your leisure.
Lots of new appointments and reappointments for us. And administrative items, number 4, and member comments.
read an interesting article this morning was in the Wall Street Journal, about developing helmets. It's being passed around. Developing helmets that could maybe fold up and go in your water bottle.
Cool.
So you don't have to carry it. So they were saying accidents in New York City, the accidents, the fatalities are people without helmets almost 100%. And there's a proposal, you would know this as an engineer, fold them up. But I thought that was fascinating.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I thought it was a joke.
No, no.
Nothing is impossible.
No.
Today.
Yeah.
Any other comments? No? Okay, so our next meeting is June 7th. And can I get a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay.
Second. Have a good rest of the week.
Thank you guys.
Whoever wants to keep it, can keep it.